Hello, and welcome to a bonus episode of the Radical Thoughts podcast. In this episode, I interview the sociologist Hartmut Rosa. We discuss his concepts of social acceleration and resonance, and the general condition of modernity in the modern world. This is a follow-up to our Virilio episode, so look for similar themes and connections with what we discussed when talking about the information bomb. Without further ado, let's get to the conversation. Hello, and welcome to the Radical Thoughts podcast. I am Patrick, and today I'm sitting with Hartmut Rosa. Rosa is a professor at the University of Vienna. He is a sociologist who works on social acceleration, and he is the author of books such as Social Acceleration and Resonance. So Hartmut, thank you for joining us. I'm really glad you were able to come and talk with me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure for me. Thanks to you.
So I wanted to talk with you because on the podcast, the last roundtable session we did was we read The Information Bomb by Virilio, and your work doesn't necessarily follow. I don't know if there are any theorists who are properly Virilian, but your work isn't necessarily in the same style or methodology as his work. But you are also interested in concepts of acceleration in society, which is not super. A super popular topic sociologically. You see it pop up now. You hear about accelerationists, at least in the U.S. and the U.K. occasionally, but it's not usually something that appears to be studied a whole lot. So could you talk a little bit about how you conceive of what you call social acceleration in society, or what led you to examining this as a sociologist?
Yeah. I think you're totally right that social acceleration is not a topic that is widely discussed in sociology, and maybe it's not very prominent in society generally. But of course, the experience that it is about is very well known, right? So I think all the people who are most of the people, at least, right, who might listen to this and know very well from their own lives that speed is something very peculiar to our society on two ends. I mean, one is that things seem to speed up, right, all around us, just digital communication, for example, but also in many other respects, it's always about speed. And very often this is related to a time shortage, right? We always seem to be pressed for time, short on time. So the impression that social acceleration, that our lives are speeding up, that the world turns faster and faster, is very well known and very familiar to all of us. But as you said, there's not much written about it. So Paul Virilio actually was one great source of inspiration for me, because he really was, almost was the only one who really thought a social and historical development and social change along the lines of a speeding up. He called it dromocracy, right? The speeding up of life. And for example, what I really liked a lot is his insight that he says the speed up of our lives is really has kind of comes in three steps, so to speak. The first is the speeding up of transport, of course, which is spectacular, and it's still ongoing in our world. When you think of it, it starts more or less with a steamship, right? But since then, it's not just that the steamships have gotten much more faster, but also that there's more ships all the time, more container ships, more cruising ships, right? Which means there is more traffic on the oceans. But of course, there's also more traffic on the land, starting with the railways, and then there are more and more railway lines and faster and longer trains, but also trucks and cars, and the number of cars is still going up in the world. And then, of course, there's also traffic in the air, which is incessantly increasing, unless we are kind of slowed down by Corona, which I've found remarkable, right? So it's literally setting the world in motion. And Paul Virilio said, well, this is just step one of the acceleration revolution. Step two is the transmission revolution. The first means we start to explore the world. We move faster and faster across the earth. But the second step is we bring the world into our homes, so to speak, and precisely in Corona times, COVID times, we do this all the time, right? We are permanently we are sitting still, and take the world in, so to speak. I'm talking to people in the United States or in everywhere, And the third, actually, if I may just a little extend this a little. I mean, what I really found fascinating is Paul Virilio. Actually, he foresaw the situation of what he calls polar inertia, right? A frenetic standstill. What was his vision in the 80s, in the early 80s? He wrote about this, that one day he said we might no longer move physically, right? So all matter or physical things might be halted down, and the only thing that is really speeding like mad with the speed of light around us are data. And a lot of people right now in their home offices have exactly this experience. They don't move physically because they might be in a lockdown, but the data are whirling like mad around them. And the last step, he said, will be a transplant revolution, a transplantation. We will implant those technologies into our own bodies.
That was the thing that we found when I was reading with my co-host, is that it has reading Virilio, it has simultaneously the sense of the book we read, I believe, comes from around the 90s, because I remember he's like talking about Clinton and Ronald Reagan and such, that yeah. It's both extremely forward-looking in terms of what he's conceiving of as the potential consequences of technology, and that book in particular has a lot about like media representation. And, but at the same time, we felt that it was kind of odd reading it in 2020 and reading back, and because it's so grounded in this kind of the talk about globalization, which is almost nearly a little bit dated at this point, because it was such a popular term or category of the time. But I found an article, I believe, where you talked a bit about globalization and the concept of acceleration as well. But you also talk about acceleration as something that is particularly modern, or modern in the sense of modernity, which is, you know, has also remained kind of a controversial, despite being, you know, one of the essential concepts of philosophy and art and everything. It's still quite controversial because now there's also theories of postmodernity and so on. So how do you really like conceive of this ground of modernity when you talk about acceleration, and how do you see it related to globalization, as in globalization in the sense of the kind of 80s, 90s turn, as opposed to, you know, maybe the you know, 1800s steamships and railways?
For me, modernity is really, it's not just about technology, right? That's something that that's a difference between my own thinking and Paul Virilio's, because for Paul Virilio, it's kind of speed is always important all through history, and he actually thinks the civilizational process almost driven by the fact that to be faster always is an advantage in war times in military operations. But for me, there is really something which allows us as sociologists or social scientists to speak of modernity, and that is not speed per se, or not even the speeding up of society, but the fact what I now call that dynamic stabilization. And what I mean is that from the 18th century onward, our modern society, its fabric, its social fabric, right, is constituted in a way that we permanently need to speed up and to achieve growth, economic growth in particular, but also cultural innovation and change in order to keep our institutional status quo, right? I mean, you see it in the logic of the economy. If the economy doesn't grow, that's well known in the United States, as in Europe, as in China or Japan or elsewhere, without growth, we cannot maintain what we have, right? Our status quo, our institutional fabric cannot sustain itself without permanently growing. And that is, growing means producing more, consuming more, distributing more, right? So growth, acceleration, and innovation are the three elements, so to speak, of dynamic stabilization. And what and that is this is really new historically, right? That a society in its entirety, so in its totality, can only maintain itself through permanent increase, because that means that individually as well as collectively, next year you have to run faster. We have to run faster just to keep our place in the world, right? Just to not fall back. And I think that's historically and new and peculiar. And this is what I define as modernity. A modern society is a society that structurally needs economic growth, technological acceleration, and cultural innovation in order to preserve its structure or to reproduce its institutional status quo. And now within this logic, there are different periods which we can distinguish, right? And that actually has to do with the speed of social change, right? I mean, I believe that when you look to earlier pre-modern society, I mean, and you're totally right, these terms are contested. And rightly so, because there's a lot of ethnocentric bias there and also normative bias. And I think a lot of post-colonial critique, for example, is very justified. But this definition is not normatively laden, right? I say society is modern or can be called modern when it needs speed in order to preserve its structure. But now the question is how fast is the speed, right? Mm. And I believe when you look to before the 18th century, right, very often society in its basic institutions had an intergenerational pace of change. And what I mean with this is that very often the world stayed the same between the grandparent and the grandchildren, for example, right? So when the grandmother, let's say, talks to her grandson, she would say, the world is such that you have to do this, you have to learn a lot or so, or you have to, deal with your passions or so. But modernity makes a change there, right? Now there is there starts to be an intergenerational change, which means that the world of the grandmother is different from the world of the grandson. Now she would say, you know, kid, in my world, it was not okay to be homosexual, for example, or for a girl to have a job or so or whatever, mm-hmm. right? In your world, it's different. So I call this high modernity or standard modernity or classical modernity. But now in our, what I call late modernity, is our age in which the world does not stay the same even within generations. So we now say, well, right now the world is such and such, but tomorrow it might be different, right? Mm-hmm. You see it in the commercials which say, well, every month or every year a new world. And this changes the way we perceive of history and of society altogether. And I call this late modernity because it is a change within the fabric of modernity, but we are still a society that can only maintain itself through dynamic stabilization, which means we are still modern.
Mm-hmm. That is that definitely, I mean, you mentioned before that this is something that that a lot of people will probably find intuitive based on a sense of personal experience or habitus or what have you. And I definitely feel personally that this makes a lot of sense, partially because I live in a relatively close family where I have regular contact with my remaining grandparents. And I definitely have seen this kind of sense that not only is there all generations can see each other changing and experiencing cultural change continuously and interacting. But yes, that sense that there is always supposed to be a new world around the corner. Yeah. And also as someone who I actually started a little bit before COVID, but it's been intensified by COVID, someone who I work from home on my computer and even though I ostensibly have quite a bit of free time because I podcast and then only do part-time work, I have that sense of intensification that I have to, you know, keep track of my time for work. I have an actual, you know, time tracking app for how I get paid and how I experience things. And if I need to always keep track of things and have that quantifiability to my time, but that seems to bleed into every kind of part of my experience while I'm cooped up right now. With the way you describe modernity also, it reminds me a lot of how one of my favorite writers, Marshall Berman, describes modernity.
Exactly.
Where he borrows the famous Marx quote, Marx and Engels quote, that, you know, modernity is when all that is solid melts into air. And I think maybe you can talk a bit about what Berman points out is he takes, you know, Faust, which I love this piece because I wrote my undergrad thesis on Faust, but you know, he says Goethe's Faust is the tragedy of development, the sense that modernity's melting away of social bonds produces a new level of human activity, individual activity that is at the same time constantly kind of effacing itself, erasing its own products, facing its own tragedies as it moves forward. So with your theory, how do you see kind of the, do you have a way of kind of having the classic sociological question of how does the individual interact with, you know, the structure or the society or the social level? Do you have a way that you try and integrate the individual level with that broader, more abstract level?
Yeah, I think this is a definitely necessary, right? I mean, you're right. We have in sociology very often we have theories which are only on one level, right? On the one hand, you have this structural theories, structural accounts of modernity, which just look at the social, at the macro level, so to speak. And then on the other hand, you have those which just look at the cultural or the individual side. And I really believe it's necessary to bring the two together, really, right? And so I try to do this in two ways, so to speak. I mean, on the one hand, what we were just discussing is that there is a structural institutional feature that in modernity, societies can only maintain the structure. Actually, it's also true for companies, for example, for organizations, by permanently innovating and speeding up and rationalizing and optimizing and so on, right? And this, what I call dynamic stabilization, translates, of course, into our individual lives through the logic of competition, right? I mean, the problem there is that we are always in danger of being left behind. Or actually, what I like is the, you know, this image of this vision of the downward escalator. It feels like standing on a downward escalator, because whenever you think, now I have enough, I have achieved something, right? You have, as soon as you take some rest or take a pause or a break, you're kind of falling behind others, right? So you buy the newest equipment, the best computer, let's say, and as soon as you unpack it at home and install it, you will realize that your virus protection is not up to date, yeah. and your software is not up to date, and so on. So it's always be falling behind, and the number of, you know, and actually it's the same with your email account, right? You answer all your emails and you're really happy, and 10 minutes later when you have a look, right, you're already down the escalator. And it's the same with your clothes in fashion or with the Facebook, with the social media, right? We are always standing on downward escalators and have to run faster and faster. And the problem is that we are all afraid of being left out, of falling behind. And that has to do with a real social change in the constitution of society, because I believe in what I call classical modernity, the idea was about a position, right? Once you had a certain position, for example, you could say, I am a baker, just to take one example. And then, and maybe you have built a house or so and have a family. And then that was the horizon within which you could develop. There was a certain career track for the job and for the family, but the idea was developing things. And generations were the bearers of innovation, so to speak. Every generation, that's different from pre-modern society, where very often you just inherited what your parents had, right? So if your father was a baker, probably you would be a baker too, and maybe you even stayed at the same house. But modernity has this idea that you should find your own family and define your own job and have a place, find a place to live. But once you had it, you had a kind of position position where you drew a certain security of the world and in the world. And now, of course, this is no longer the case, right? You'd rather tend to say, right now, I work as a baker, but it might well be that the company closes down or that bakers are no longer needed in the future or that I will move to other places and so on. So we permanently, so there's no longer, it's no longer about positions, but about performance. How are you doing? What's the quota? What's the standing? We permanently have to watch our activities and optimize our scales. I mean, another element of this acceleration game, as I call it, of course, it's a quite deadly game, a serious game, is that we have more and more parameters of our lives. I call it parametric optimization. So you have to keep track of the number of steps you take per day, or of your blood pressure, of course, but or of the oxygen level in your blood, or of, and so on, many body-related things, but also social things, right? How many followers, how many likes, what's your quota, how many people listened to your podcast last week, and so on. Yeah. And so we have more and more of these visualizations, quantifications, which we need to optimize. So one thing is we're driven by fear. We're not driven by greed. We are driven by fear to a large extent. But nevertheless, since you mentioned Faust, I like that. I draw on him a lot too, right? I think our society, this logic of speeding up the world, is not just driven by fear and competition. There's also, it's our conceptions of the good life, right? What makes life good? What are we trying to achieve? And I call this the triple A horizon of the good life. Sounds a bit complicated, but it's actually a simple idea, I believe, that we have come to believe, to live in a way that expanding the horizon of what is available, accessible, attainable is defining the good, really. I mean, for example, this is why money is so attractive, right? If you have a lot of money on your bank account, then the world is available, accessible, attainable to you. You can take a trip to Rio de Janeiro or to Tokyo if there's no COVID crisis. And you can buy this expensive car and you can afford this wonderful apartment in the center of San Francisco or Los Angeles or wherever you are. And if you don't have a lot of money, then all of these things are not attainable, available, or accessible to you. And it's not just what makes money attractive, it's also what makes technology access attractive, right? So the new, I mean, actually, if you allow, I mean, I find it really interesting when we look at the story we developed with Virilio, the story of transport. When you think back as when you were a small kid, let's say, and you got your first bike, why was that a great thing? And you really felt thrilled by it, because the horizon of availability or attainability or accessibility increased. Now you could visit your friends on the other side of the village or the town, for example. And then when you got the first moped, for example, or the motorbike, you could extend this to the next city or even more cities. And with the car, of course, the horizon of availability expands. And with the plane, it expands again. And with the smartphone, you have all of your friends available with one click, and all the knowledge that ever was digitalized, and all the music and all the movies. So we are driven by a conception of the good life that is defined by the idea of expanding the horizon of the AAA, availability, attainability, accessibility. And that, of course, is something that fits very well. That's the cultural underpinning that motivates us to play along with the speeding up game.
I think that notion that it's a simultaneous fear, that element of fear and competition alongside a desire for the good life makes a lot of sense to me, especially with Faust. I think of there's a section where Mephisto says something like with money, I can buy 6 horses and their legs are all mine because I have that power now, that my speed, they make me speedy, that is absorbed into my living being, my way of living. And of course to use a very complex word, somewhat superficially, the kind of dialectic, right, of losing control, but at the same time we're this is all producing an immense amount of human power, human capability. But at the same time, it's somewhat well, melting into air and seem so inaccessible.
Yeah, well, if I may interrupt you there, but I find this really most interesting. It's something I'm thinking about right now, right? That on the one hand, and you really see this well in Faust, in Goethe, that's true. I mean, on the one hand, we have permanently increased our power of what we can do, right? We have almost become omnipotent in many respects. I really think when we think of our relationship to nature, for example, with the nuclear fissure, right? With the power to split the atom, we have now... And when you listen to Oppenheimer, for example, right, he was really celebrating this, and I understand it very well. He said, now we have the power to command matter from the inside. That is vastly increasing our horizon of attainability or availability. But on the other side, this gave us a strong sense of powerlessness when you think of a nuclear chain reactions, right, the atomic bomb or the exploding nuclear power station. And that's the situation we have with nature generally, right? We have come to dominate nature in almost all respects. But on the other hand, we feel that with the climate change and global warming, right, we feel totally powerless. We cannot do anything about it. And finally, and this I find most interesting in our individual experience, our everyday experience, on the one hand, with our remote controls and smart homes or smartphones, we have become almost omnipotent, right? With a click of my thumb, I can make it bright light or dark night. I can make it very warm or very cold. I can play loud music or soft music. I can even change the color. It can be yellow or blue. I'm almost omnipotent. But when the remote control fails, even if just the battery is empty or broken, right? I cannot do anything. I cannot even open the door or open the window. So I think our situation is really like, as you just described it, it's a permanent going back and forth between omnipotence and complete powerlessness.
That might be a good note to bring up. One of the things that you mention in one of the brief sections in your book, Social Acceleration, you mentioned very briefly, but you note that you make the point that you've already made, that one of your critiques of him is that he transhistoricizes the role of speed as a social drive. But you also note that he sees it almost as a primarily political factor or something that is politically perhaps consciously driven by political interests. But as you're describing and as we're kind of talking, like, the kind of way that we've been describing it is that it's the sense of powerlessness there is almost in fact because it's even beyond, say, just political factors, even though I'm sure political competition would play a role in things. Obviously nation states want to speed up and have that the Weberian social calculus, that rationality. I get the sense that you would say that it's not necessarily something that is primarily driven by the political interest as such.
I think it's very complicated. I mean, historically, as you say, I think the interests of the nation state played a great role there, right? Because it was really, I think in my take for a long time, it really was also political action and political power that that changed society into that mode of dynamic stabilization. It was, it was nation states building all the infrastructures for it. And by, what Michel Foucault also describes with the institution, with the discipline, society, right? It changed the way of life, and with the educational programs and with the economic policies, it all was geared towards this mode of dynamic stabilization. And there, of course, there was a great fusion also between political interests and economic interests, because of course the accumulatory logic of capital is one of the driving factors and motors of social change. And in my take now, politics, particularly democratic politics, really is no longer the pacemaker of this historical acceleration, because politics is inherently slow. I believe that's a part of our democratic crisis, because democracy is not just about taking a vote. Democracy is in itself a time-consuming process, of formulating positions and arguments and deliberating them and then taking a decision in a process where positions and arguments are changed and exchanged. And that's time consuming. And in our age of the fast markets and the fast media, politics is always kind of lagging behind. So you can really see in the last decades, at least after the, you know, the end of the Cold War, politics is a kind of, is not the pacemaker, but it's the fire extinguisher, right? It's become a kind of a kind of emergency reaction and no longer the leading action. And but of course Capital still has a, you know, I'm close to Marx in that sense that he says the real subject is not even politicians or politics, it's the logic of capital. But as we just discussed, I think it is very important to see that there is a cultural underpinning there which you cannot just reduce to economic pressure.
This might be a good way to try and bring in one of your more recent works, and you have a TED talk on this as well, is you have a what you call a sociological theory of resonance.
Yes.
Which I don't know. I unfortunately haven't had the chance to actually look at your book yet. The blurb on the back or on the Amazon page, it says, you know, it's proposed as a quote solution to the problem of modernity's acceleration. So I guess how would you describe your theory of resonance, and how would you say, you know, I think one of the big issues today is that a lot of proposed solutions and things, it's easy to get kind of trapped in a sort of mentality, sort of self-help, figure out how to change your mind kind of thing. And how would you say that this is a sociological response?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm grateful for that question because I definitely don't want to write or did not want to write and don't want to propose a self-help thing and not even a mindfulness theory because the resonance theory is not about our subjective states or emotional states, but I tried to dig very deep at the heart of modernity and about how it could be different. And the way my thinking went is like this, you know, I wrote the book of Acceleration and a lot of people read it as a critique of the permanent speed up of our world, and it was a critique of it because I said we lose we lose our chance to lead good lives if you're permanently pressed for speed. And then people thought that I'm advocating slow down, right? Slow food, slow cities, slow everything, the social deceleration. And I always thought that's not right. I haven't actually written about deceleration. I've wrote about acceleration, and I think there is no solution to just slow things down, because slowness, on the first place, slowness is not a good or an end in itself, right? I mean, no one wants to have a slow fire engine or a slow internet connection, for example, is just a pain. So slowness cannot be the goal. And on the other hand, it's not possible to leave everything as it is and just slow things down. Because it's very deep, this need for speed in the fabric of modern society. So I thought, well, what is the problem with acceleration? And my claim is that not all forms of speed up are bad. Speed only becomes a problem when it leads to alienation, right? And alienation. Mm-hmm. Well, alienation means, you are alienated from a city, let's say, or from a job, or from your friends, and in the end, even from yourself. When you are no longer capable of really appropriating things or people, right, of really establishing a connection to them, right? For example, when you travel from one city to the other, in the end, you lose the capacity, right, to really appropriate the place, to take it in and let it affect and change you. And it's the same with people. If you talk all day to different people, then in the end, you no longer really encounter them. You no longer open up to them. And it's the same with our own doings all day, right? If you're permanently working on your to-do list, you do this and you do that, then at the end of the day, you really feel empty and drained because you have the feeling that you never really opened up to anything. So I had this idea that speed is a problem when it leads to alienation. And I wrote this book on alienation and acceleration. It's a short book. And then I realized that the problem with the concept of alienation, I wrote about alienation from people, alienation from work, alienation from nature, alienation from ourselves. But the problem with the alienation concept is that we don't really know what its opposite is. What is a non-alienated way of relating to a place or to a person or to your own body or to nature, right? And then I looked into the history of the concept, and in critical theory, it was very prominent, like with Adorno or with Marcuse or with Walter Benjamin and Erich Fromm. And of course, it comes from the early Marx, right? But the problem was that it's very unclear what the opposite is. I mean, Adorno had this idea of a mimetic way of being in the world. And Marcuse, actually, quite interestingly, I like him a lot. He says we should leave this Promethean stance of relating to the world that you find in Faust, right? Prometheus as the person who wants to control everything, and develop rather an erotic relationship with the world. And eros is not tied to sexuality. It's a much broader concept there. And Erich Fromm has this idea of spontaneous way of acting and working and being in the world. So what I tried to do is to think of what it means to be related to the world in a mimetic, erotic, oratic, to use Benjamin's term, or spontaneous way. And this is how I defined resonance. Resonance is alienation's other, right? So you're non-alienated. You overcome alienation once you're in resonance with the people you are living with the nature surrounding you or the work you're doing. And resonance is a relationship. It's not an emotional state, a subjective state. Relationship that has four elements. Number one is affection. Something really touches you or speaks to you or affects you or moves you. Bruno Latour, the French sociologist, says you feel called by something, right? It's the call. And sometimes we use it in everyday language. You say, oh, this book really speaks to me, or it resonates with me. And then you think that what you mean is that it really affects you, it touches you. But the second element of resonance is that you answer this element of affection, right? It's emovere, emotion, moving outwards. You answer it, and there you experience some form of self-efficacy. I can reach out and do something, either by talking to the person you encounter, or by thinking with the book, or with a theory you read, or by even by kind of reproducing the music you might hear within you. So the second element of the second moment of resonance is self-efficacy. You feel alive and in an efficacious way, relating to your environment. And the third element of resonance is transformation. You do not stay the same. You're not just optimizing your parameters, but you're transformed by this encounter, by this touch. And the fourth element, I've written a new book on this, small book. It's called Uncontrollability. And what I mean is that uncontrollability has many aspects, but as the fourth element of resonance, it means that you cannot buy or commodify resonance, right? And you cannot engineer it. It's a non-engineerable thing, because we always try to guarantee resonance by, for example, particularly by buying things. But you can buy an object. You cannot buy resonance. That's the trick of capitalism on the consumption side, right? We yearn for resonance of a real encounter with nature, for example, right? And then you buy the cruise, for example, then of course you have a right, you can commodify the cruise, but you cannot commodify the encounter, the resonance. But what is the second element of uncontrollability is that whenever resonance really happens between you and your friends, for example, or at your workplace or in your family, the transformation cannot be controlled. No one can foretell or predict what the result of a resonant encounter will be. So for me, resonance is an idea that has a socially transformative power. And that's why I want to use it as an idea, as the opposite, opposed to the logic of capital accumulation, but also an alternative to the AAA conception of the good or the good life, right? Because being in resonance with people or things does not mean to optimize a certain horizon of availability, attainability, or accessibility, but to really experience resonance in a certain way. And resonance is something we can, you know, it also depends on the institutions. There are a lot of institutions, the institutions of a modern society, of a late modern society in particular, are not geared towards resonance, but towards actually to leave out this element of encounter in order to make it absolutely predictable and rationalizable and optimizable and economically fruitful. So I believe there is an inherent tension between a society that is geared towards, that looks for, that has a conception of resonant relationships with the world, economic, institutional, educational, in the care industries, in agriculture and ecological respects and so on. So resonance is not an individual mindset, but a social way of being in the world.
We have just a little bit more time left. So I guess I'll, to close off, obviously you have plenty of books that people should definitely check out. We've mentioned a couple of them. But as a sociologist, you know, what in social acceleration, you mentioned kind of drawing upon the frameworks of what might be called the kind of classic, the classical, you know, sociologists, Marx, Weber, Durkheim. But if people are listening to this and they're not, you know, a trained sociologist, I'm not, though I am applying to a master's in sociology. So fingers crossed there, maybe I'll be able to do some work on this. But what do you think, that there's any other good research or sources that, or ideas or concepts that people should really look at if this is something that they are intrigued by and would like to try and understand more?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's a number of things which I find very inspiring, I must say. I mean, actually, it's very interesting to just read by Marx, The Communist Manifesto. It's a well-known piece, right? And it's not even completely academic. Yeah. But you can read it in very many ways. And one way to read it is really as a manifesto of acceleration, because there he really, you know, I mean, as you said, Marshall Berman wrote his whole book about all that, about this line, all that is solid melts into air. It's from The Communist Manifesto. And he describes how the logic of capital accumulation brings about an incredible speed up of life and changes everything. So he certainly is an interesting source. And then modern day writers like David Harvey, for example, the geographer in the postmodern condition, for example, he picks up on this and talks about time space compression, right? Where we permanently, it's a change in the way we relate to space and to time simultaneously. And it always comes in the sense of a compression. So I think he is really a great read in this aspect. And we already talked about Paul Virilio. But what is also very interesting for the cultural side actually is Charles Taylor. He inspired me a lot to understand our modern predicament from the cultural side, right? To see that underneath even our economic institutions, there are certain cultural aspirations and yearnings, and his sources of the self, for example, or legitimation crisis are still a great read in this direction and along these lines. And of course, Richard Sennett's book on the corrosion of character is very interesting when you look at the effects this change has. I mean, Sennett describes, I quite like that, you know, that in what I call classical modernity, right, for a long time, people, you know, the difference was that everyone had to find his own job, but then once you had it, you have it. But nowadays, people change their positions about, I think, 18 times on average, and also their locations. And he thinks that this is a corroding effect on character. He might overdo it a bit, but it's a very interesting read, certainly too. So actually, there are many, many, many things to be read.
I certainly hope that listeners take inspiration from this conversation, and I think that there are definitely a lot of things to be explored from these perspectives. I've been thinking a lot about, as you mentioned, you know, the sense that everyone is working many different jobs and shifting between positions. I know I've certainly experienced that. That is also kind of matched with this. I remember seeing there's actually an advertisement for some sort of a work shoe that said, the advertisement actually said something like, "You will never retire, get shoes that won't retire either," something like that, which was almost a little bit dystopian. Yeah. Just outright saying, you know, you're never gonna settle down. But also thinking about the way that one trend that's been interesting, at least in the United States, has been that the since 2008 with the housing crisis, we've seen how the kind of post-war boom in the idea of everyone owning their own home that was, you know, so that was a source of so much movement is kind of fading out, and we're realizing that a lot of people might return to older ways of long-term, multiple generations in one home. But at the same time, there's no, you know, the kind of work stability, the career stability, all those things have not slowed down. So you get people living with their parents and stuff, like I certainly have. And at the same time, they have to constantly work all these different jobs, find things, move between careers all the time. So there's a very strange kind of effect of that speed up, while one aspect of speeding up and perhaps slowing atomization down. Slowed down, and then one aspect kept going.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's always a kind of dialectics also. Many forms of speed up actually lead to forms of deceleration, and also sometimes, like, I mean, very interesting example is the traffic jam, right? Everyone wants to move fast, and in the end, no one can move anywhere or anyhow. And there are other things to be read, by the way. Liquid Modernity by Sigmund Baumann, for example. Or on the political side, my colleague William Scheuermann has written interesting stuff, and I have on liberal democracies and the empire of speed. And we have edited a book, High Speed Society, and there are a lot of other authors like Reinhard Koselleck or Hermann Lübbe and many others. Georg Simmel, by the way, as a sociologist, he said he used the image of metropolitan life for modernity per se, and he says the main characteristic of modernity is the high speed within inner cities, and he wrote that more than 100 years ago. So, yeah, so I think it's an interesting topic. And it was great to talk with you about it.
All right. Well, thank you, Professor Rosa, for joining us. Thank you, all listeners, for joining in on this conversation. And we hope that you'll join us next time. That was our conversation with Hartmut Rosa. We hope you enjoyed. Some of Rosa's works can be found in the links below. And remember that our next episode is, well, we've already recorded our episode for this month. It's on Zizek. It should be out pretty soon. But the next book that we're reading is going to be Gillian Rose's Sexuality in the Field of Vision. So make sure you get a copy of that if you want to read along. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you next time.